Accession number 11938, reel 32.
Mr. G. Iceland, reel 32. Looking for a breakout and planning for it, Mr. Iceland, how did you negotiate mine fees?
Well, on the breakout, we used our own gaps in the minefields, which we used very well. We knew very well. But when you break into somebody else's minefield, well, let me say in the first place that our minefields were always marked by wire, very often concertina wire, but if not, there'd be a strand of wire with skull and crossbones on it, a white sign with a skull and crossbones on it to mark the minefield.
And that sign would be facing you, not the enemy?
It was facing everybody, the enemy as well. I think it was in the I think it's part of the Geneva Convention, but I wouldn't be certain of that. And certainly the Germans, they were pretty good at marking theirs. The ITIs, they didn't care. I don't think they had any pattern for minefields. They simply dropped them and that was a minefield. I should maybe explain that a minefield, it's not just a matter of putting mines down on the ground, because if you drop them too close together and one is exploded, that could explode the whole minefield. Just the explosion from one mine could set the whole minefield off. That's not the purpose. The purpose of a minefield really is to alert the people behind the minefield that there's something happening in the minefield. For instance, I think in the First World War they used trip wires that used to just make a noise. Very often they put a trip wire with shell cases on that used to rattle so that they knew there was somebody prowling around. And I think that is really where the minefield started from. Now, the British always had a pattern. We had certain lectures on them, but they were nearly always laid by the engineers, Royal Engineers. But in later days, there was an assault platoon came in to the battalions with S Company, and they were fully equipped for laying mines, lifting mines, and booby traps, and dealing with booby traps. And normally, there would be a... If we can take a triangle, there would be a tank mine or a heavy mine on each corner, and probably a personnel mine in between. A personnel mine was various types. It could just be an explosion that took a leg off, or it could be an explosion which shot a tank in the air full of ball bearings and they're scattered all over the place like a shell bursting. They had another one which just kept the kneecaps and sort of took the kneecaps off. There's various personnel mines. But it was possible to go to drive through a minefield and not touch one, just depending how you look, because we tended to drive to miss various rough pieces. And it was possible to get through. In fact, quite a few did. And a lot of the cases that I had to go out and bring them back, it was the back wheel which had caught the mines. They negotiated the front wheels all right, but they'd forgotten that the back wheels are always inside the circle. If you're turning a corner, the back wheels are always inside. And very often it was a back wheel that got caught. And really, they didn't. In some cases, it caused a lot of trouble because they might blow the thing right over and then people could be trapped inside. But in a lot of cases, just blew it on its side and you went out and changed a wheel and a brake drum and one or two more of it and put it back on the road again.
If you had had to go and pick up a vehicle that had been damaged in a minefield, it must have been pretty dangerous for you. How did you get through to it?
Well, we tried not to do it at night, but occasionally it had to be done at night, depending where we were. But we tried not to do it at night. And we're all taught to use the bayonet to find mines, and through the day you can, unless the mines have been there a long time, you can see that the ground is loose where the mine's been dug in, so it's not quite as serious as it would sound. Of course there was no metal detectors then, He couldn't just waft around with a metal detector. In fact, I think they came in about, certainly looked Alamein, but I don't think we used metal detectors before Alamein. It was all, the lads went out on their hands and knees, or even on the bellies and the knees, and they stuck the bayonet in. If the bayonet went in fairly easily, they knew the soil was being disturbed within a reasonable time. And very often you would tell by the sound of the bayonet touching. A tank mine, it had to have a certain weight on before it did anything. In fact, it could walk over a tank mine and not do anything, but it was the ones in between which were the trouble, the personnel mines. And there was another funny thing with a gap when you were breaking out of anywhere, or breaking into anywhere, I should say, rather than breaking out. The mines, the gaps were narrow, obviously. I mean, they wanted to, the REs were in there first and covered by Bren guns or whatever there was, and they had to break, get the mines out and cleared, and so that the vehicles could get through. So naturally, they were fairly narrow, and I've just explained if they didn't get the circle quite right, it was possible to catch a mine. Now, with the track layers, it was a different thing altogether, because the track layers have much less weight per inch on the ground than the vehicles have, because you must think that the vehicles have four wheels touching the ground, where the track layers have got a track. I mean, that is their name, a track layer, tank or a carrier. But if they have got to turn, they have got to slew the rot round. The tracks in a straight line has got to be slewed round. And that, of course, puts a lot of weight onto a mine, and that sets it away. But in a lot of cases, it was a back wheel thing.
So in some circumstances, a track vehicle could literally drive straight through?
Yes, because they're much lower in weight per inch on the ground. And it was possible to get through. Some tanks were specially reinforced underneath. And then, of course, later on, they brought the flails out, which was a series of chains on front of a tank which spun round, and they hit the ground very hard before the tank was actually in the position. I never actually saw it in operation. It sounds a bit horrendous, but this was the system. They were away in front, I should think maybe 15 feet in front of the tank, and if the tank was properly reinforced, I suppose. Well, they were. They worked. There was no doubt about it. They just drove through the minefield.
What kind? You talked about a triangle.
Yeah.
What kind of distances between the corners?
I can't honestly remember, but I think we're talking about something like 80 yards between them, because of the explosion sort of hits the ground, and then that sets one up, travels along the ground, just as they do the seismic graphs now. They're setting an explosion off, and then they measure it so far along. Well, the same sort of thing used to happen with mines if they were too close.
So the common view, that the film view, you might say, of a minefield where there's a mine every 2 or 3 feet away from each other.
You can't do that. But later on, and especially with the Italians, they used to plant these smaller mines, which were more likely triggered. I mean, you could just trigger them by laying your rifle on them or anything like that. They were the banks for the infantrymen. But they were no harm to the track layers. I mean, they were just no damage to them at all. It was the big mines that were the problem to the track layers. And as I've said, it was possible to get through a minefield without, in fact, the in the early days, they used to walk through the minefield. The infantry used to walk through the minefield, and then the REs came along behind and cleared the track for the vehicles to get through. And it was still done, I believe, at one of the attacks at Alamein. It was done again. Because, the talk of Alamein of one battle, but it went on 10 days. And I think there's one occasion when the infantry actually marched through the mines, and then the REs followed on, because it was really bad, fixed lines going across, and the infantry had to go through and get shot with the machine guns before the IRAs could do anything. It was just impossible for them to work.
Coming out then of the box now, then you were obviously on a course for coming out on a different route from what had originally been planned.
Yes, we were back in the box, in fact. And I'm not quite certain what happened, but we did go right through the box. And I think at one stage you could see where we'd actually been. But we didn't go to it. We didn't stop to go and see it. And then I think we must have come out of the box sort of at the north end of 151 Brigade's box before it got to the South African box, because it was mined all the way. There were solid mines between the two boxes. It was between the South African box and the 151 Brigade box. It was solid mines. You know, it was a minefield, big one. And I think we came out of, I can't remember the gate now, but we came out of there and into the desert on the east side. And we were heading for, on the, I have explained that most of the African coast, you've got a sea line, and then behind that you've got an escarpment. And at Gazala, it was quite a high one, I think about 600 feet. It was quite a naughty one. And it's a funny coastline, really, because it goes north, northeast, southeast, northeast, and southeast. At Gazala, there was a very big, should I call it an inlet? It was more or less, they called it the Gulf of Bomba, but the Gulf was a very wide thing. It's all gulfs, the north coast of Africa. There's the Gulf of Sidra, the Gulf of Gabies, where what they call the bloke now, he's claimed it now, goes about 6 miles out to sea, but it's actually, well, maybe more, maybe, I forget what the distance is now, but it's a very big expanse of water, and he's claimed that now as part of his territory, but it is really his international water. And then there's the Gulf of Sidra, the Gulf of Bomba is the one at Gazala. But at Gazala again, there's a very deep inlet which goes right down to the escarpment. I mean, some places you get about 4 miles from the escarpment to the sea, but at Gazala itself, it's down to yards. And the road, the coast road, runs practically right underneath the escarpment. When it gets past Gazala, it does open out a little bit, but the road still runs pretty well to the escarpment. And there are numerous passes down, but they're all very, very steep. They're hairpin passes, you know, you're doing U-turns all the way down and round U-turn again, then down again. Well, you drop about 400 feet, I think, you drop down until you got down to the road level. And then there was the Elagala Pass, but it was named the Elagala Pass because the road that ran down, it actually ran across the coast road and the way up to the coast to a place called Elagala. There's two Elagalas. There's one west of Tripoli, and then there's this one which was on the coast east of Derna, sort of between Derna and Tobruk. So it's the Derna Tobruk one that we're talking about, the Elagala there. But Elagala was about 4 miles from the actual pass, but it was still known as the Elagala Pass. And then beyond that, there were two more passes. And then the coast ran east southeast towards Tobruk and its armour and the Egyptian border Salum, and then onto Alexandria and turns back north then to Palestine and all the rest of it. On the opposite side of the Gazala line, the German side, was very high country, and it's called the Jebel Coastal Region. And that was very high, rough, mountainous, you'd say. And then, as we got down the country a bit, towards Tobruk, the escarpment seemed to run out. And there the desert sort of went straight down to the sea, or into sand dunes. And then that stayed that way all the way around Tobruk and Derna. Is Derna or Barber? Derna. And it's that way all the way around.
So what terrain were you facing with as you left the box?
Well, the idea was to get off the escarpment down to the coast road, because we knew there was a tank battle to the south on the escarpment. Another funny thing I'd like to mention while we're on this subject. In the Libyan part, towards the Egyptian country, I can't remember seeing any rivers. It seemed that the desert between the escarpment and the plateau in the south was just like a dish, without rivers flowing out of it. East of Tobruk and in the Tunisia area, there were very deep wadis where the monsoon-type rain used to run away into the sea. Can't remember that anywhere around Gazala. And I can't remember a lot of rain. We were there from February to June. I don't remember a lot of rain. But when it did rain, it seemed to hang on the surface. And that would turn to mud. And it would be messy for maybe a day. And then the sun would come out the following day and dry it all up again, just like a brick underneath. So if it was wet, it was messy. And then the sun came out and the wind came and it just dried up and you were back to desert again. So there was no sort of natural ways down to the sea that we could sit, that I can remember anyway. There was a bridge, I think, in Tobruk at the east and at the west end of the Tobruk Harbour. But I can't even remember a river there. I suppose there was, but I just don't remember it. Anyway, we carried on and we got underneath the south side of the escarpment. Well, not underneath the escarpment, I'd say on top of the escarpment, because it's pretty level all the way through from there. There we ran into a problem, because to get down the passes, it was single file. We had to take the passes sort of nose to tail again, just as we'd done at night.
Was this still night time?
No, we're into daytime now. And which was a bit of a problem, because while we're hanging around for the people to get down these passes, you see, we had the 9th Battalion in front of us now, pretty close in front of us, and we were still doing this rear guard thing. The South Africans had got out, they'd used the coast road and they'd got out. Now, I was just saying about when you get towards the brook, the escarpment sort of vanishes a bit and you get a slope going down rather than a steep bank. Now, Rommel was dead crafty, because he picked this place to break through and cut the coast road. He used this because he had a nice sweep, and I suppose his idea originally was that if he could get to the coast there, he could come back up by the side of the escarpment and trap anything that was coming. Which he did, in a sense. We were sort of now in a very open formation, because we've been the Stukas had arrived and found us on the top of the escarpment.
So were you parked up there?
We're waiting for people to go down, you see. So we're in very open formation. George and I were very busy, because we've been travelling all night, you see, and we had various bits of breakdowns to attend to. And I think we had something like 15, 18 people on the back at that time. The people were picked up and from various places.
Had there been much damage to the column?
Not a great lot, no. No, as I said before, I can't remember firing anything. I wouldn't have fired it in any case, because at night it would give you a position away. But I can't remember leaving anything at all. But that doesn't say we didn't. I mean, something could have hit a mine and been pushed out the side and just left.
And did the Stukas find you, and did they do any damage?
Yes, but in an open formation, they don't do a lot of damage. Not when you're not as open as we were then. Wait, just wait to go down the pass. There's one thing I don't quite understand is why we didn't carry on and sort of do the same as the Germans had done and go down the south side of the escarpment and then just run into this bit of open country that was on the way to Tobruk. Unless, of course, we knew by then that the road had been cut. I don't know. It is possible that we knew. Because we're only talking of a distance of some, 20 miles, I suppose, from Gazala to the end of the escarpment. Something like that, anyway. I just can't remember now. But while we're waiting on the top of the top of the escarpment, we were trying to get busy. We were busy doing what we could have been. We went topping vehicles with water and lube and petrol and taking stuff off the truck, fortunately, because by now we had about 12 to 15 passengers. I think we had a blow-up. I'm almost certain I remember a blow-up, but who made it, I don't know. It certainly wasn't me. I don't think it was George. But one of the lads on the back had probably brewed it up for us, and we had a drink of tea, and that was our first since before dusk the night before. And I should think by now we're getting on towards, could be 10 o'clock, I should think. So we'd been quite a while without anything. And we enjoyed that. And also we found out there that we're heading for Tobruk. And that was our destination. And, of course, at that time we were thinking that Tobruk was like a safe haven, as it had been in the previous run back to the frontier. And we'd been told then that we were going to Tobruk. And the sounds of battle, as we're having our cup of tea, the sounds of battle, they were getting really strong. We had the Armoured Battle in the south, which we could tell was getting nearer all the time. There were shells coming from, we could hear them on the other, landing the other side of the escarpment. Then there was a battle east of us, which we didn't know much about it at that stage, but we could hear rifle fire, which is not very nice when you hear rifle fire. It's a bit too close to be nice. The odd shell coming over, that's one thing, but when you hear rifle fire and it's pretty close, that's not very thrilling at all.
Were the men quite touchy at this time?
They were getting very touchy because, well, I suppose everybody over the last 3 weeks had very little sleep, really. I'd had practically none. And I don't think George Adams had had very much either. And, of course, the lads in general wouldn't have had very much sleep because there was patrols going out every night and there was various activities which would disturb the sleep. And it turned out that the 9th Battalion had run into the 15th Panzers as they proceeded. I mean, we didn't know this at the time, but we knew there was something going on to the east of us. And the 9th Battalion run to the 15th Panzers. And then the queue started to get a bit tighter on the top of the passes because everybody was anxious to get down. Just as we were sort of queuing up to go down these the pass, we could see tanks prowling around behind us. I suppose at this stage we sort of 8 to 10 miles out of the box on the east side. And these tanks seemed to be going up and down the wire of our box. Well, not our box, but the South African box. And we thought they were probably enemy tanks, but we had no proof of it. But by the time we were sort of getting ready to go down the box, these tanks approached us and they let us know whether ours or not. Our tanks had done a magnificent job in holding the situation until the South Africans got out, but they had 12-hour start of us, you see. And then we had to sort of go back and follow their tracks.
Were these tanks enemy tanks?
Yeah. They'd played a nice one on us, the South Africans. Well, you can't blame them. They'd blown the Gazala Gap. As they pulled out, they blew the Gazala Gap. So that was one gap, one pass less that we could use. There was the Elagala Pass and another two. I can't remember the names of the other two. But as we were sort of getting to the top of the pass in our turn, we were at the end of the column by now, of course. These tanks were coming down and throwing a shell or two at us. So then we knew who was down to earth then.
Who was controlling the traffic at the top of the pass to get it down in any kind of order?
I don't think anybody, quite honestly.
Just the question barging in.
I think, well, I wouldn't say there was any barging in, but certainly when the tanks started patrolling, when it could see the tanks patrolling, the queue at the top of the pass got a bit heavier, let's say. And going down the pass, it was certainly nose to tail again. Well, as close as you could get there, go. It was daylight, so there was no problem in seeing. And anyway, you could only follow the pass. There was nowhere else you could go, unless you wanted to go from top to bottom in one spell. There's nowhere else you could go. There's only this narrow pass you could get down. And we got down the pass, and it was a great feeling as we started to go down. You know, we thought, well, that's out of their trajectory, you know, they couldn't shoot down at us because they were behind. And we were reasonably happy with ourselves again at that stage, until we got to the bottom of the pass. And then there was nobody in front of us. They'd vanished. And we soon found out why, because some damned heavy shells came lobbing across at us on the coast now. And they were coming from the old German lines, sort of west of Gazala, of our Gazala line. Oh, they were heavy stuff. But fortunately, the pass was round the corner from them, and they couldn't get a range onto the pass. But they were lobbing quite a few over, and it wasn't very pleasant, I can tell you. It was safe enough in a sense. It certainly wasn't very pleasant. And we were going along the road, and we finally caught up with one or two. We picked a few more up.
Now, were you basically the last down then?
Yes.
Off the
escarpment? As near as I can tell, we were the last going down. We might still have had these two carriers behind us. I wouldn't swear. We had two carriers who were sort of the definite rear guard. But I'd been travelling as a box. Was carries in front and a couple of anti-tanks. I think we only had 20 tanks, so there'd be one each side. We had no 25-pounders, but we had quite a few carriers because they'd been out on patrol, you see, and we would pick them up. They were sort of covering the battalion as they went out, and then they covered the night battalion as they went out. And so they were the last. So we had quite a few carriers with us. And I think there was supposed to be two carriers behind.
Was the road surface metal, though?
As near as I can tell, it's metalled all the way through, yes. Those places where it had to be widened. And where the REs had widened it, I mean, they'd just shot some holes into it and blown a gap here and there. Passing places, you might say. And then the rubble used to sort of drift across the road, so you couldn't really tell whether it was metalled or not in some places. Well, the road at the bottom, the coast road, sort of clung to the bottom of the cliff, which was very fortunate because that took us out the sight of the heavy guns that were across the Gazala inlet. And we picked one or two more up on the way. And then we came across a 25-pounder in the quad. And I think the quad had actually been hit. In any case, it was in a safe position from the guns at this time. When we got there, they decided that it was out of action, and they were pumping shots through the tyres and removing anything which they wanted, I suppose. We stopped to see if there was anything we could do for them, but they'd already decided the quad had had its day. And the RAF captain who was with them, he asked if it would take the man, you see. So we piled them on board and any bits and pieces that we could. We're now at 30 plus on a 30 underweight vehicle with a slip and cut. And then somebody shouted, "He's opened that 25 pounder on the tow bar." So I just cracked at that. And that was it, you know. I mean, I was at the end of the tether by then. If he thinks he put the 25-pound, I don't know what a 25-pounder weighs, but I know it's damned heavy. A 2-pounder is about 2,500 weights. So I know 25 pounds is a lot more than that. And with a, well, I mean, I was really under the weather at this stage, and there was a lot of barracking off the back, and he said, "You're not doing that." So I went out and I got hold of this RA captain, and I told him we had a slipping clutch, and it was just more or less impossible for us to do anything like that.